Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Making Memoir Magic. Today, I am excited to be on the podcast, as always, and so grateful to Radio St. Pete for having me. And I know we are smack dab in the middle of the holiday season. I celebrate Hanukkah and Christmas, so we started on Sunday night, and we've got Christmas a week from today. So if you celebrate, I hope that it's going well for you, and if you don't, I hope you are able to find some meaning this year. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today as it pertains to memoir, instead of teaching, I'm going to read a passage from my book, actually a chapter, but it's not a long chapter, but from my book, because, you know, memoir obviously is made up of our memories. You know, the word memory emanates from memoir, and, you know, we write based on our memories and the ones that are most poignant to us in what we've experienced and transformation that we've gone through. And, you know, a memoir is a snapshot of your life. So it can be any amount of time. It can be a year. It can be 10 years. It could be your childhood. Mine happens to be 22 years that I was a political spouse. And for me, that meant, you know, a lot of change, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of naivete at first. And I learned a lot. And that's the core of memoir is your transformation, your personal transformation as told through your stories. So with that said, this Friday, tomorrow, because we're recording this on a Thursday, is the 10-year anniversary of one of the most memorable nights of that 22 years. Now, you might think, wasn't the most memorable night when your husband won election? And not always. Those were fun, great evenings. But the one I'm going to read about to you from chapter 12 in my book, Accidental First Lady, talks about a night where we found ourselves with only 2 days' notice at the White House. So without further ado, I'll start. And this chapter, like I said, is chapter 12, and titled Cordially Requesting the Honor of Your Presence. When Rick was first elected to public office, we knew it would mean long days, countless meetings, and lots of encounters with constituents. What we didn't anticipate was the mountain of invitations to luncheons, dinners, fundraisers, galas, and even restaurant soft openings. During his years as a city council member and state legislator, Rick would bring home stacks of invitations. Once a week, we culled through them, calendars in hand, weighing what to accept. Attending evening and weekend events comes with being a politician, but Rick and I agreed that accepting lots of invitations wasn't conducive to a healthy family life. When Rick became mayor in 2013, the invitations quadrupled. Instead of perusing them together, city staffers vetted them. His public appearances had to be coordinated with a security detail and scheduled around the meetings that filled his 12-hour days. Rick tried to maintain a schedule of no more than 4 nights out each week. Most of the time, my name was included on invitations as a courtesy. I carefully chose the events I attended as I weighed the pros and cons to determine whether an event was worth being absent from our young kids on a school night. When I did accompany Rick to events, people I didn't know often stood in line to speak to him. Some interrupted our dinner to speak to him even after the event program had started. The image of people bending down to speak to Rick, their backsides to my face, reminded me of movie characters paying their respects to a don. Accessibility is necessary for a mayor to effectively serve constituents, so I learned not to take it personally when it was obvious people sometimes only wanted to speak to him. Rick always introduced me to the people who knew him. Anyone who wanted to speak to him would have to say hello to me. I was happy to often play photographer when constituents wanted a selfie with the mayor. In the beginning, invitations felt like intrusions that took my husband away from me when I wished he were home helping with the kids or sitting next to me on the sofa. When it was clear that Rick wanted to devote most of his working years to public service, I decided to embrace this role. I began to view social events as opportunities to learn something new about our community. I looked forward to finding at least one person with an interesting story. Often, we'd end the evening as friends, promising to follow up at coffee or lunch. Of all the invitations we received over the years, one stands out. The invitation, sent electronically from Barack and Michelle Obama to attend a 2015 White House holiday party. We felt like we'd won the lottery. Rick and I had admired Barack Obama since the first time we met then-Senator Obama on a cold Sunday morning in February 2007. We stood in the driveway of a modern corner lot home with expansive rounded windows that faced Tampa Bay. We were among a handful of guests who spoke with Obama before he went inside to address the crowd. By the following February, Obama was a presidential candidate. Spouses are routinely tapped to serve as campaign surrogates, and Michelle Obama was one of the best. It was a rare weeknight when Rick and I were to attend an evening event together at another Tampa home where Mrs. Obama would be campaigning for her husband. Samuel's fever came on an hour before Rick and I were to walk out the door. It was too late to call a sitter, and the grandmothers were unavailable, so I suggested Rick take Jordan instead. She was 9, old enough to stay up past her bedtime on a school night. That night, Michelle Obama politely shook Rick's hand, but she was more interested in talking about American Girl dolls with Jordan, who was the same age as the Obama's eldest daughter, Malia. 10 years later, when a call went out for memorabilia to be considered for inclusion in the Barack Obama Presidential Center, I sent the photo of Mrs. Obama with her arm around Jordan and the story of the conversation between two American girls, a future First Lady and Jordan. Shortly after Rick was elected to his first mayoral term, he was invited to join other new mayors at the White House for a roundtable with President Obama. The Oval Office meeting wasn't run by a cabinet staffer. It was Obama who listened when Rick talked about affordable housing and climate change. Like Obama, Rick also had hope. As a new mayor, he wanted to reduce poverty, increase equity, and create a better life for St. Pete residents. "He's so real," Rick said. Rick returned home with a chocolate White House that will never be eaten, matches that will never light a fire, and souvenir napkins embossed with the White House seal. The Obamas' holiday party would be our second visit to the White House as a family. Our first trip in 2007 included a self-guided tour where 5-year-old Samuel impressed a security guard in the Blue Room who asked him to name another United States president besides Abraham Lincoln, who died in office. Without skipping a beat, Samuel blurted out, "William Henry Harrison." Still determined to stump him, the security guard asked Samuel what caused President Harrison's death. "Pneumonia," Samuel said, correctly identifying the infection of pneumonia that Harrison's doctor and many historians say killed the 9th president after only 32 days in office. Parent volunteers who'd observed Samuel in his kindergarten classroom would stop me in car line to tell me how Samuel recited the presidents forward and backward. The hard-covered Dorling Kindersley Book of Presidents with the weathered spine lay next to his bed. Reading and rereading the pages nurtured a natural curiosity for history and politics that had nothing to do with what Rick did for a living. The only security guards who spoke to us the evening of the White House holiday party were the ones who told us to empty our pockets and purses. Twice, they waved their wands over, under, and in between. We stood in a long line that weaved like those at Disney. We searched for familiar faces amid the ball gowns that sparkled against the business casual ensembles. There were men in snappy business suits and men in chinos and blazers. I wondered how they came to be invited to a White House holiday party. I surmised that our invitation was the result of Rick's steady support of Obama. He was the first elected Democrat on the west coast of Florida to publicly endorse Obama's first candidacy for president. We finally got into the hallway that led us to the room where hundreds of partygoers were already gathered. Tuxedoed waiters milled through the crowd offering champagne. We ran into Rick's 2013 campaign manager, Cesar Fernandez, and his fiancée, Eileen, who already had their champagne. Behind the main room was a long rectangular room with several tables. The platters of shrimp, filet mignon, cheeses, fruit, and the best macaroni and cheese I would ever eat hadn't yet arrived. White and milk chocolate replicas of the White House, ice cream sundae stations, cheesecake platters, and candy lined the perimeter of the room. We postponed our champagne for 4 front row spots across from a lonely lectern that stood like a wallflower waiting for a dance partner. I was sure that's where the Obamas would stand when they addressed the crowd. My toes, which had been shoved into rarely worn black patent leather pumps, barked angrily while we waited for the hosts. I thought about the front row seat I'd had to Rick's political career and how it led us to the ones we had that evening. "Make friends with your neighbors," the man from Obama's security team suggested as he proceeded down the line repeating the same instructions every 3 feet. Without taking a breath, he recited how we could all get a picture with the Obamas. "No selfies with the president, though," he warned. We were to give our cell phones to the person on our left. They would take our photo with the Obamas. Our new friends would return our phones and give us theirs. We would snap their pictures. A memorable and historical party favor for sure. After about 90 minutes, the crowd grew silent. "Hail to the Chief" played, and the Obamas descended the grand staircase to join the lonely lectern that was now the center of attention. We were only about 100 feet from them. President Obama speaks as if the words are only meant for you. He seemed to lock eyes with every individual in the room. His jokes made us laugh, but his words inspired. We had no idea how much we would miss his calming and intellectual oratory once he left office. That year, the Obamas hosted 20 holiday receptions at the White House. I'll bet Michelle Obama could tell me about sore feet, but I forgot about mine as we strolled the White House halls. The Christmas tree dedicated to military families, each ornament a service member's story, brought tears to my eyes. The life-size replicas of Bo and Sonny reminded us of our Labradors. Vanderbilt University's a cappella group, the Melodores, drew crowds as they sang beautiful holiday songs. If Rick hadn't said yes to running for city council in 1999, we would have probably spent that Friday evening falling asleep to Netflix. Instead, Rick and Samuel got high fives from the president, and Jordan and I got one of Michelle Obama's famous hugs. It felt like a reunion with old friends. Nothing lasts forever, and the political bubble eventually pops. Politics has brought challenges that we would not have had if Rick had continued running his law practice. But this life has also provided gifts. The physical ones, tokens of appreciation and awards, usually end up in Rick's City Hall office. Gifts of experiences live in my heart and in relationships with people I might have never met if I wasn't a political spouse. That has left me humbled, inspired, and grateful. Michelle Obama's life changed because of her husband's job, but it didn't change who she was. She is married to a man who was the most powerful person in the world for 8 years. She had been a political spouse for 18 years, but that night in 2008, when she spent a few moments talking to a little girl about dolls, she was a mom. Long evenings, picking at chicken dinners, standing next to Rick while others lobbied him, or waiting at home while he advanced his career, led to one of the most treasured evenings of my life. I am grateful to have been invited to the White House holiday party. I am also glad I listened to my teacher's advice. Always pick a seat in the front of the room. That's where the best stuff happens. So I hope you enjoyed hearing that chapter from my book, and I hope it sparks a memory for you, whether it's about the holidays or a moment in your life that you never thought would happen. And perhaps that could be the start of your memoir if you are thinking about writing memoir. And if you are thinking about writing memoir and have trouble accessing those memories, look at old photographs. Obviously, this is radio, so you don't see my book, you don't see the pictures. But inside are pictures of my daughter and I with Mrs. Obama and my daughter and Mrs. Obama that night in 2007 at the home in Tampa. But that is one way to jog memories. And this time of year is rife for making seasonal and holiday memories. And you never know what memory might jog another event or experience that you had that could start your process of writing your memoir. So I hope that this inspired you. I hope you enjoyed it as a light holiday story. I know it's something that I'll cherish forever. And I wish you nothing but the best for the holidays, and to always keep writing and believe in your story, because you have a story to share. Your story is valuable, and it's up to you to tell it as only you can tell. So happy writing.